Welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff, and we're delighted to have you with us today. Today, we're speaking with author Priscilla Kogan, who is also a clinical psychologist, and that brings enormous insight into her writing. Her writing is witty and delightful, and at the same time, very insightful. I asked her to come and speak with us about her book called The Unraveling Thread, which talks about a family whose daughter is affected with velocardiofacial syndrome. Frankly, I had never heard of this, and this is the second most prevalent chromosomal abnormality, second only to Down syndrome, and it's still widely misdiagnosed or not diagnosed. So we're going to talk about this fascinating syndrome and about the unraveling thread. Stay with us now, and we'll be right back after this message. We're glad to have you with us here on The Powerful Patient. The Powerful Patient works with people who are dealing with complex medical conditions or who may be struggling to get a diagnosis. We help you learn how to manage your health, form a partnership with your healthcare providers, and manage your healthcare team. The Powerful Patient is produced by the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance. It is funded by you, our listeners, through your generous contributions. Read about us on our website at powerfulpatient.org. We welcome your questions either by email or by telephone. They really help to shape our programming. So let us hear from you at 1-800-767-4845, extension 6. Thank you. And now I'd like to introduce you to Priscilla Kogan, author and screenwriter, and a number of other things, too.
So I understand you're a clinical psychologist.
Yes, I have been a clinical psychologist, and I had a private practice up till, I was a head of a large clinic up to 1997. I had a private practice, and I was at a clinical director of this three-county agency for about 10 years until about 1988. So it was a family therapy agency
that we did. And since 98, you've been focusing on your writing?
On writing, that's right. It's much easier. Much easier work, I tell you. Oh, dear, I don't have to work with the insurance companies.
Right.
So, and the wonderful thing about writing is if you meet an obnoxious character, as I often had to do with the insurance companies, I can either make them more obnoxious for a novel, or I can just hit the delete button. It's omnipotence.
You can also do punitive things to them, and you won't be accused of murder. That's
absolutely right. Absolutely right, Joyce.
Oh, well, you shared with me your book, The Unraveling Thread.
Uh-huh.
And this is very interesting because it tackles a complex medical condition in a novel, which people don't often do.
Uh-huh.
I work with people with another complex medical condition, von Hippel-Lindau disease.
Right.
And so I was interested to see that you've really depicted it well, not only the medical aspects, but also the family dynamics around
right.
these people.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about why you decided to write about
velocardiofacial syndrome.
Yeah.
Because I have a niece with it, so I've had personal experience mm-hmm. with it. And it's never been written before in fiction. So it affects, I think, 1 in 1,400 births. And it's the second, so it's the second most common chromosomal disorder to Down syndrome. And yet it is still misdiagnosed by a lot of the medical people. The ones who really know about it are pediatric neurologists.
Hmm.
And adult neurologists are still missing it. So, and school people, a lot of school people don't. They see these children who sometimes look, these kind of oval faces and seem to have a lot of physical problems, but practically all of them have some kind of learning disabilities. There are some that have mild retardation, but that is, I don't think, a particularly significant feature. But everybody who has velocardiofacial syndrome has learning disabilities, And so I think a lot of these kids are not properly diagnosed, and it's a simple diagnosis to make based on a blood test. But
uh-huh.
it took,
so there is a simple blood test.
There's the FISH test, F-I-S-H.
Yes.
And my niece wasn't properly diagnosed until she was 33 years old.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
She went through a bunch of diagnoses when she was young. She had, failure to thrive. A lot of them are failure to thrive infants. And cerebral palsy, and she had just a lot of operations. She had a cleft uvula. I mean, there just were a lot of physical things wrong with her. And then when she became an older teenager, she began to have pronounced hallucinations of all kinds. And so she was diagnosed as epileptic psychosis because she had one grand mal seizure. She was diagnosed as schizophrenic, and I kept telling my sister, I know schizophrenia, she's not schizophrenic. And she was diagnosed as, atypical psychosis, which probably was the most correct diagnosis if you're just looking at the emotional aspect. But what it is that the valocardiofacial syndrome, these kids are missing about 40 genes on the 22nd chromosome. And what they have, chromosomes come in pairs, so there's one chromosome that's fine, and then there's one chromosome that's got a deletion. And sometimes the genes need the genes of the other chromosome to activate or to restrain or whatnot. But
mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it depends which of these genes on the chromosome are missing.
That's right, absolutely.
What aspects come up for the child.
Yeah, and there's about 184 associated symptoms to valocardiofacial syndrome, and no two children are exactly alike. It depends
right.
what is missing. And so it's an incredibly overwhelming disorder for the parents, the syndrome
right.
for the parents, because they're dealing with so many physical problems. There are a lot of neurological problems associated, too, with this.
Right, and you do a good job in the book of explaining the different kinds of things that could happen, not only to the young girl who's in this book, but also
right.
the different aspects that can happen. And so if people are have a child who's having a hard time getting a diagnosis, I think it would be helpful to read your book. It's a good lesson in family dynamics for everybody far as that goes, but it also gives you a sense of the kinds of things that are in this syndrome, and
uh-huh.
maybe you should ask your pediatrician to explore this.
Yeah. The book, this was a character with that, so it's the first time in fiction. And then, so one of the things, the agenda of the book is just to acquaint the public with that.
Right.
But the main character, the family is the character, is the protagonist.
Right.
And, I had a male agent say, who is the protagonist in this novel? And it was so clear to me, it's the family. But
yeah.
you have a whole family. You have this woman who's in the sandwich generation. She works outside the home. She's very successful. But she has her mother with Alzheimer's who's living with them, who's a wonderful character by the name of Opal. She has these two fraternal twin girls, teenagers, one, and they're 15, and one has this mysterious illness that nobody seems to be able to diagnose correctly. She has the other who's just resentful about having a disabled twin. And she's divorced, and she has a six-year-old boy who just wants her to get back together with daddy. And she's got a dog with attention deficit disorder. And so everybody laughs when I say that. She's got the dog with attention deficit disorder. But you have to, in essence, when you are overwhelmed with these kind of medical problems and issues in a family, you have to have a sense of humor.
Absolutely.
If you don't, you will die. And so the book has a lot of humor. I think it has some pathos in it, too, because, you really
yes.
can feel what this woman, Harriet, is going through as she's trying so hard to keep this family together. But I've had people just read the book and tell me it was one of the funniest books they ever read. And, to me, that's just, I told my sister who has the daughter with VCFS, and I think that just struck her as sort of odd, because she sees, of course, this VCFS 15-year-old really struggling, and the mother struggling to get the proper diagnosis. But I want to tell you a story, if I can.
Please.
There's a woman who comes and helps clean the house with me once a week. She's a Bosnian who's now an American citizen. And she, during the rest of the week, she's in home health care. Mm-hmm. And she was telling me that she had this woman who is in her home health care, who's 62, who has a lot of physical problems and has been depressed and really doesn't leave the house for 3 years and is in bed a lot of the time. And I don't know what the specific problems are, whether it's MS or something. But the woman's been very depressed. And she said, I've been reading your book, she said. So I gave her the book and I said, read a few chapters. And so she went about doing some things in the house for the woman, and the woman started to laugh. And she began to laugh more and more as she was going through the book, The Unraveling Thread. And the next day, the supervisor came in to see the woman, and I guess it was the regular nurse or something came in, and she said, what did you do to this woman? Her whole attitude has changed. And she said, well, I just gave her a book to read.
Neat.
So that was really neat. I mean, you know, I didn't quite expect that with The Unraveling Thread. Certainly my first three novels are very healing novels, and I've gotten lots of feedback from people about them, about how that's helped heal things in them psychologically. But The Unraveling Thread, this was kind of one of the first times, except I've gotten a lot of feedback from parents of VCFS kids who are so appreciative that somebody has finally written about it.
Right. I think one of the things I really liked about it is that everybody is slightly imperfect, as we all are, and yet they don't take themselves too seriously.
That's right.
You know?
Even the dog.
The mother who's sort of, you know, as you said, slipping into Alzheimer's, she's beginning to lose her marbles, but she's still a great character, and you can appreciate her and get along with her and have a nice day out with her. And you don't focus so much on the loss as you focus on the woman who's there.
Uh-huh. And then I brought in the Native American character. And every woman who I met while doing book signings this summer, when I said the tagline for the book is, where is Mary Poppins today, now
yes.
when you really need her? Every woman who has a family understood
yes.
that. And indeed, this Native American woman comes in, and because she knows the paranormal some, she is indeed like a Mary Poppins character.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because I've not only been trained in clinical psychology, but I've also been trained in Lakota Sioux medicine work. And because my husband's Cherokee, and we follow the the Native American path, and when these are very different healing systems.
Yes.
So I sort of inserted her viewpoint too.
Right.
That's quite different. So it's a funny novel, but it also deals with really issues, and all my novels have a lot of humor in them. Even the one that I wrote about the problem of evil and the nature of healing has a lot of humor in it, because I think you have to. A life, I think, at times is very absurd as well as being overwhelming. And I think you have to laugh.
Yes, agreed. Now, one of the things you grapple with is that one of these parents really cannot cope with the child who has a disability and really just leaves.
Yeah. That's the ex-husband, who is a wonderful villain. I really enjoyed writing him. And you're right about, you know, as a novelist, you can just indulge yourself. It is true he's a politician, and I think I was getting caught up in the political, you know, fervor of the day. But he wants to be sensitive, but he can't. And he's sort of manipulative, and I think there's a lot of growing up of the twin who isn't disabled. She finally has to confront her father about some of his manipulations, and that's taken a lot of courage on her part.
Right, that he'll invite the well twin and not the disabled twin.
Right.
And that becomes very painful for the girls.
Yeah.
For both of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's take a little break here, and we'll be right back to speak some more with Priscilla Kogan about her book and about filocardiofacial syndrome, or VCFS.
This is Keith Richards, a.k.a. Just Saying. Is there cancer in your family? There is in mine. But it doesn't have to be bad. We can take action to protect ourselves. I've learned how to get screened and manage my health so that I'll live a long, healthy life. How about you? Visit www.powerfulpatient.org. Again, that's www.powerfulpatient.org. Peace.
We're back now speaking with Priscilla Kogan about her book, The Unraveling Thread, which is a fictional account of a family affected with VCFS, or velocardiofacial syndrome.
So, but it is true that sometimes confronted with a problem like this, sometimes the parents are able to work together and it binds them together better, and other times the parents get ripped apart by this.
Now, I was asked this summer to, there's this organization called the Velocardiofacial Education Foundation. And they were doing their international conference. And so they invited me this summer to come and give a dinner speech. I thought I was one of many dinner speeches. I turned out to be the dinner speech. And what I had heard was that the year before, there was a woman who got up and had a very functional VCFS kid, a velocardiofacial syndrome kid, and who was doing very well. And so she got up and gave a real inspirational talk to these parents, and she said, you know, your VCFS child can be whatever she wants, he or she wants to be. And a couple of women got up and left that conference in tears because they knew that wasn't true for their children. Mm. And so I, in essence, kind of responded to that and talked about that is certainly something to, it's an inspiration, but it's sometimes not the reality.
Right.
And so how do you face medical problems for which there is no solution? I mean, when your problem is at the core of your biological foundation, it's at the DNA level. You can't cure that. You just work at one symptom after another. You'll do surgeries, you can't go change that DNA. At least not now.
And just respond to it as best you can.
You respond to it as best you can. And as parents, when you see your child suffer so, it just tears you up inside. And how do you accept your own limitations as a parent in terms of you can't? Sometimes, my niece now, who is about, I think she's 44, 45, she has pain. She would describe the pain in her eyes. It feels like hummingbirds are flying into her eyeballs. Well, nobody mm-hmm. knows what that means, but she obviously experiences pain, and a lot of people don't know what this pain is causing the pain, and they've tried, to find out, but it's the biological system is so messed up. So sometimes... Mm-hmm. You try to do what you can do, and that's as far as you can go.
Right. I know several doctors who have handicapped children themselves, and one of them said to me, it's so hard for me as a doctor to have to admit that I can't do anything for my own child.
Mm-hmm. And right now, these VCFS kids are prone to, their immune systems are compromised.
Yeah.
And so they're prone at times to malignancies. And she's just been diagnosed with uterine cancer.
Mm.
So, and they discovered she had a divided uterus. I mean, again, it's that biological system. And so the surgeon says, well, let's just go in and take out the uterus. We have to do major abdominal surgery to do that. We can't do it, through the normal way through the vagina, since one side of the uterus doesn't even empty into the vagina. And the question is, can she survive emotionally that, and the mm-hmm. quality of the suffering, and how will that compromise her living situation? And so my sister, they're just having to make awful decisions. And I said, it's not only quality of life you have to look at, it's quality of death. And you have to factor in the suffering.
Right.
And so it's, you know, my sisters, they're just, and she's wonderful because she does a lot of education. Once they got the diagnosis, she immediately began educating other parents and accompanying new parents of VCFS infants, you know, to appointments. And my brother-in-law, who's a biochemist, he immediately began trying to set up trials of possible medication to help those who have the psychotic factor. About 25% of them will become psychotic. So, you know, the talents of the two of them have been very well utilized, but now they're really having to look at what kind of quality of death for her and versus kind of suffering. So, it's very painful.
Yes, it certainly is, and I really appreciated the way you looked at the way all of these family members are interacting,
mm-hmm.
not only the parent and the disabled child, because there's always, as you say, a very complex relationship there and lots of difficult questions to be wrestled with, but the other children, the well children in the family, are trying to find their own place and
That's
their own
right.
relationship to the parent and their relationship to all their siblings.
Right.
And everything is very complex. And as you say, having this Mary Poppins character come in and try to help each of them
and
find
the dog.
Their place. That was and the dog. Help them all sort of find their place in the world and in the family. It was very healing.
Yeah. The sister of my niece, as she's written now a book called Requiem for Locus, and that's coming out in November. And that's the second book that features, has a character with valocardiofacial syndrome. And she takes her emphasis on her book, which is more, I think mine's, you know, a much more, it's a funnier book. It's easier to read. Hers is more a literary book.
Mm-hmm.
And it's extremely well written. But she's looking at the neighborhood. What's it like in the neighborhood to have somebody who is mentally ill? And the impact that has on neighbors who tend to be very isolated from each other. And so she's looking at it from the neighborhood perspective.
Yeah, there's one incident in the book where this little girl, Sola, erupts into psychotic accusations of rape and murder.
That's right.
That are absolutely unfounded, but there
That's
are
right.
the hallucinations in her head.
Right.
And obviously she calls the police, and it's
That's
disruptive,
right.
as you say, in the neighborhood.
Yeah, and that's all based on behavior of my niece when she was living at home. And, you know, the police would arrive and they would say, we had a report that there were dead bodies all over the house. And, you know, so, and they began to understand that there was
right.
a person who was experiencing, you know, profound mental illness. And her brain structure, I mean, her brain, she has frontal lobe cells where they shouldn't be, and so mm-hmm. Her brain betrays her, and so they began to use talk about voices, because she would have persecutory voices in her that would say she stunk, that she was male, that people were talking about her. And she still has that somewhat, but my sister's done such a wonderful job of saying, oh, those are the voices inside your head talking to you. And she understands that her brain feeds her false information and that she can't trust what is reality, so she has to check what is reality from, you know, from other people. And I think she basically uses her parents. I mean, she calls her parents
right.
about 10 times a day. They don't answer the phone 10 times a day, but... But she does call them about 10 times a day from her group home.
So she's unable to distinguish between reality and hallucination. But,
yeah.
but she's at least learned that she needs to validate that.
That's right. That's right.
And that's a big step.
That's a big step. And she's the reason I knew she wasn't schizophrenic is she was incredibly empathic. I mean, just incredibly empathic. I mean, she might be, when she was in the state hospital, this is before they diagnosed her correctly, and she would be just going on and on in a crazy way. And then she'd say to a psychiatric aide, oh, you must feel so badly that your boyfriend is away, you know, on vacation without you. And she just comes out with these. And I remember when I went to the state hospital to see her, And there was a fellow who was schizophrenic, and he was walking by, and he had that sort of cloak of invisibility that you see in a lot of chronic schizophrenics in state hospitals. Like, nobody sees me, you know, and they just sort of shuffle down the hallway. And she stopped him, and she said, "Ben, I want you to meet my aunt, you know, Priscilla Cogan." And Ben, his eyes, and she treated him with such respect, and his eyes came alive, and he suddenly reached out, shook my hand, and said, "Glad to meet you." And it was so wonderful to see Christy, how she, that was my niece, how she just treated these people around her with respect. And then when Ben went on, he again assumed that cloak of invisibility, in a way, and shuffled on. But for a moment, he was alive because she recognized him. And she has that wonderful ability to do that. So there are just things about her that I knew she wasn't schizophrenic. I didn't know what it was, but I thought it was organic. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know what it was. So.
Right. Well, it's good to know that there are syndromes like this that can be identified. And one of the important aspects of identifying it correctly, it would seem to me, is that then you understand the other things that may occur as part of a syndrome, so you can begin watching out for them, mm-hmm. and get them treated properly so that they don't sneak up on you and do devastating things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So.
It certainly is quite a package of difficult situations.
Mm.
Yeah. So tell me, you have experience also, you said, with Lakota medicine. So could you talk a little bit about that? You mentioned
sure.
that it's quite different medically.
Yeah.
The approach is quite different.
Well,
in what way?
Well, my first book, Winona's Web, there ended up being a three-book series, because I realized I wasn't finished with the characters, but each book was different. But in the first book, Winona's Web, is about a 69-year-old Lakota Sioux medicine woman who moves to a reservation from Pine Ridge Reservation, South Dakota, to one in Michigan, where her daughter's married to a Chippewa fellow. And she ups and announces to her very modern daughter that the spirits are going to come collect her in 2 months' time. Well, her daughter didn't believe in the old medicine and drags her mother off to see a 39-year-old Irish-American clinical psychologist by the name of Dr. Maggie O'Connor. Now,
yeah.
Maggie was divorced and a feminist and knew nothing about Native Americans. And Winona was your client from hell because she had no intentions of participating in this thing called psychotherapy. But she took a liking to Maggie O'Connor. She thought the psychologist was naive and unbalanced. And so without the psychologist knowing it, she decided to work her brand of healing upon the psychologist, some of which involved the paranormal. So the storyline of that book is who is healing whom, and it's funny, as all my books are, but it was an exploration about how these two cultures looked at death so very differently. And it's going to be made into a movie. It went into 10 languages. It's all over the world. And it was used. It's been used sometimes in hospice, and I've had enormous amount of feedback, actually from all over the world, about people who either are in the process of dying or people who've just lost somebody, about how helpful that book was to them. And then in the second book, I dealt with what we call trickster energy, and it's the love affair between the psychologist and the medicine man who's Winona's protege. And in that one, really, there was a lot about parents learning to forgive themselves for the mistakes that they made. And then I thought, well, I have to deal with the problem of evil and the nature of healing. So in the third book, the second book was called Compass of the Heart. The third book was called Crack at Dusk, Crook of Dawn. Mm-hmm. And in that, the medicine man and the psychologist, who are now a couple, are having to deal with a child who has had horrendous experiences and been contaminated. And the medicine man says, you only have to look in the eyes of the boy and you can see his soul has been stolen. She says, don't make it worse than it already is. It's post-traumatic stress disorder. So again, I was exploring the difference of these cultures and understanding what had happened, the phenomena, and they had very different ways about healing. I mean, you know, she was looking at the kind of mental health, and he was looking at the spiritual aspect of bringing this boy back. And And right. So it's you know, I've lived in two worlds for a long time. We used to make our living as psychologists. My husband also a psychologist, and first half of the week we would be operating as psychologists, earning our living that way, mainly with Anglo clients and Black clients. And then the second half of the week, Native Americans would be coming in for healing ceremonies, and we would never charge for those. And we'd use sweat lodges and pipe ceremonies and work with them to try to help bring people back into balance with the natural world, with the grandmother Earth. And so very different ways, very different.
Let's take another little break here, and we'll come back and talk some more with Priscilla Kogan about post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Von Hippel-Lindau disease, or VHL, is a genetic condition involving abnormal growth of tumors in some parts of the body. VHL occurs in every ethnic group worldwide. At this time, there's no cure, but research is helping those afflicted and their families learn how to manage their disease. When a family member has a tumor, it affects everyone in the family. VHL Alliance works to improve diagnosis, treatment, and the quality of life. Finding tumors early, getting the best treatment, and sharing information with others to help them cope is what VHL Alliance is all about. They're available to help lessen the stress of living with this lifetime chronic disease. Support the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance at VHL.org. That's Very Happy Life, VHL.org. 1-800-767-4-VHL.
We're back now talking with Priscilla Kogan, this time about post-traumatic stress disorder.
Well, let's talk about post-traumatic stress, because I think this is a very complex issue. And it happens to so many people. I mean, my husband had 14 rounds of major surgery in 15 years.
Uh-huh. Wow.
And at the time, there was no talk about post-traumatic stress.
Yeah.
But then after the Vietnam War, I began to read articles about post-traumatic stress, and I said, this is exactly what he was going through.
Uh-huh.
You know, all the trauma and all the emotional upheaval that he had been squelching in order to be brave and so forth had really done a number on his ability to function.
Right.
Both emotionally and professionally. So, and I think you're quite right that it's both a matter of medical healing. People who are coming back from Iraq with head trauma, for example, there's definitely a physical element in there, but there's also this very deep spiritual element. And how can we heal it when in our medical system we don't even address that? How do you fix a broken spirit?
Right. And in the last 10 years of my private practice, I was heavily loaded. I was the only person, eventually my husband joined me, who was willing to work with what at that time was diagnosed as multiple personality disorder and then became the dissociative identity disorders. And these were people who probably before the age of six were violently abused, generally within family systems, authoritarian family systems, but they were sexually abused and suffered PTSD in that manner. Those were some of the most horrific stories I've ever heard about human beings. It became very clear to me in the work I was doing with these people who presented me, I mean, I had to confront my own conception of what evil was because of the things that had happened, that of the things people, generally parents, had done to these children. I didn't know how to else to conceive it except as evil. So I had to go back and understand what my own conception about evil was, which I worked out in that book, Crack at Dusk, Crook of Dawn. But I realized there had to be, for these people who were, they had to answer the question, why would people who were supposed to love me and nurture me and upon whom I was dependent for that nurturance, why would they do such things to me? And that there had to be a spiritual answer as to how do I make meaning out of my life. That's they had to both remember the things that happened, but they had to construct a meaning for themselves so that they could live into the future. And that, I think, ultimately is a spiritual issue.
Yes. Yes.
And I'm having to smile, Joyce, because right now I'm sitting here and there are three wild turkeys on my deck looking in. the natural world.
That's very
interview.
Lovely.
Okay. Anyway.
That's great. No, it really is true that if something like that happens to you and the people who are supposed to love you, in fact, abuse you, then there must be some way of escaping that reality or putting it into some perspective, no matter how illogical.
Uh-huh.
And so either you decide that, well, then you're not lovable, which a lot of people do, or you begin, as you say, with this dissociative personality to kind of pretend it didn't happen and put it in
right.
a different plane.
Yeah, you split off the consciousness, you know. And so people would say, well, then you taught them your spiritual system. I'd say, no, I would really try to work within their spiritual system if I could. If a person didn't have a spiritual system, then I would try to hook them up or get them connected in some ways and to provide them maybe with some imagery of connection. But it just seems to me that one of the things, and I listened to one of your programs. It was on managing fear. I couldn't get the other
yes.
one to play, but it just seems to me that biologically, we do not expect our bodies to betray us. You know, when you're dealing with the physical kinds of illnesses,
right.
we expect our bodies to continue, and we expect our bodies not to age either.
Right.
And so we get. The body is the building block for the conception of self. That's one thing I learned very back in the early 70s when I was dealing with a youngster who would say to me, when I put my hand in front of her, I'd say, whose hand is it? And she'd say it was her hand. And she didn't have any boundary between her body and the world around her. And she'd say, I'm afraid that the front half of my body will fall off the back, or I don't dare stand next to the window because I'm afraid the wall of the hospital will fall off. And then I realized before we could ever do anything called psychotherapy, I had to get her back into her body.
Yes.
Because the body is the building block for the sense of self. And if the body is assaulted by disease, by illness, by abuse, the sense of self is assaulted. And I think that brings the whole issue about how do you experience a sense of wholeness in both yourself and your spirit when your body is being attacked. And I suspect that's exactly what was happening with your husband.
Yes.
That his body was constantly being assaulted and his body was betraying him.
Right.
You know.
And he always wanted to be strong and, you know, achieve things and be a marathon runner and win all those battles, you know. And when he was able less and less to do that, it was very devastating for him.
Yeah.
So, and I think all of us, whenever we age or have a physical ailment, we have a sort of grieving process we have to go through for everything we can no longer do. You know, I can't run that fast. I can't climb that many stairs, whatever it is, that we have to let go of that. And
right.
letting go of that is hard. And that's the sort of, I guess, adjustment disorders, as they say in the psychological trade, that you have to adjust your thinking to the new reality. And not all of us are really ready to do that.
And there's another step. I mean, people talk about you have to let go. Yes, you have to let go of the old definitions. You have to find new definitions.
Right.
You have to reconstruct. You know, I remember my father, who was an extremely well-known, internationally well-known ophthalmologist. And when he was in his 70s, he lamented, he was down at the National Eye Institute, he lamented that things were getting so complex in his field that he was having trouble following it. And I said, well, you're 77 or you know, and your job now is not only as to be a mentor, but you've got to be the historian, because you're one of the few now who can remember the great ones that came when you were a young man, the great ophthalmologist. And I said, that's your task now. And, you know, he thought about it. I must admit, he was very open to suggestion. And so he founded what turned out to be the American Ophthalmological Historical Society.
Uh-huh.
And started that. I mean, that became a new whole adventure. But he had to redefine himself.
Yeah.
He could no longer define himself as the young man, the young researcher who could do these fabulous things. And I think that it's a process of, you know, redefinition. It's not just, it means letting go of the old definitions and accepting new definitions. And there were those wonderful, being 61, I can't remember very well, but there are those wonderful books, you know, on developmental stages, and you get up to 60 and this happens. And but they have these big blocks of 10 years, and I think that's just so phony, because I think we're always having to let go, and we're always having to redefine. I mean, reality
right.
keeps pushing at us, and it's not one nice 10-year chunk. I think that, you know, we all are presented with issues that we have to face, whether they're biological or familiar, you know, having to do with a family and...
Right.
So
just like a woman who's defined herself by being beautiful and having long, flowing golden hair, and then all of a sudden she's finding gray hairs. Now she's got to somehow redefine her reality and understand that she's still beautiful and redefine beauty.
Uh-huh.
And that's just one trivial example of the kinds of things that people go through.
No, but I've seen that. Luckily, I never did define myself as physically beautiful, so I never had to go through that.
Right.
I always had inner beauty joys.
Right.
Oh, dear. You got to have humor. If you don't have humor, you're lost.
Now, with the Lakota medicine, tell me a little more about Lakota medicine. If you're dealing with someone with a spirit that needs to be healed, how does one go about doing that in Lakota medicine?
Well, one of the things we've gotten ourselves into an unnatural world, and one of the things is help a person reconnect with. Let me back up. In the Lakota world, you have what's called Wahantanka, which is probably it's the great mystery. It's I suppose it's a little bit like Yahweh. It's like the name that can't be said, but then is known in the masculine and the feminine face of Grandfather Sky and Grandmother Earth. Okay,
mm-hmm.
And there is this giveaway energy that goes between them, that they nurture and they take care of. And there's this incredible, you can say global energy that's going between the two of them. And healing comes from being able to tap into that energy.
Mm-hmm.
But that goes on between them. And feeling yourself kind of connected back into the natural world, understanding that the human being is an animal. And it's a very different conception. I mean, in Christianity, you have the concept that there's human being is kind of at the top of the list, and then there are these other species that are maybe for your use, or some people call them resources. But that's not the way in the Lakota world. You're just an animal among animals. You're a two-legged among four-leggeds, among crawling things, among fins, among... you know, the weird ones. And you exist in a network of the creation. And so you understand that all around you are your brother and sister nation. So it's a very different conception of where you fit in the creation. It's a much more, I would say, humble kind of position.
So all living things are interdependent.
All living things are interdependent. And there's a wonderful story, and it's a story about how most of the stories that have to do, by the way, with illness are stories of falling out of balance, of the human being falling out of balance, and or losing the sense of respect for the rest of creation. And you'll see over and over again, those are crucial stories.
Let me take a minute here to do a little station break before we go on to the story. Please remember to go out to powerfulpatient.org on the internet. You'll find there the handout that goes with this show with information about Priscilla Kogan, about the other people that we've talked about, the websites we've mentioned, and the books we've mentioned, and other background on this topic. And as always, we will appreciate your support. We depend on you to help fund this program. Please donate to the Cancer Research Fund and bring us back another day. Stay with us now, and we'll be right back with Priscilla Kogan and her story about disease from the American Indian tradition.
But the story of disease, I'm trying to think which tribe it is. It may be the Lakota, it may be the Cherokee tribe, but there's the story of disease where, I think maybe it's a Cherokee story, where the human beings are no longer treating the rest of creation with respect. And so the animals gather together to talk about it and seeing how can they do that. Well, the bear say, well, let's hunt the human beings like they hunt us. But yeah. It turns out, you know, his claws are not good for hunting. And finally, somebody, I think it was somebody, said, well, why don't we, every time they hunt us without respect and they take our lives and they don't give thanks for it, why don't we give the hunter or somebody in his family a disease? So each of the animals then took a disease. I think with the deer, it was intestinal disorders. So each of the animals took a disease and gave, so they would give that hunter a disease if that hunter took their life without respect. Well, the plant nation said, you know, the two-leggeds haven't been so terrible to us. So they decided that for every disease the animals gave the human beings who hunted without respect, that they would have an antidote.
Mm.
So there was this understanding of this sort of balance within the world. And that's why I think there are a lot of Native American healers are herbal healers. But there's also that very spiritual aspect that you have to be in balance with creation. And there's this whole understanding that death is just a transition from one dimension to another dimension, that the spirits are all around us, that the trees are alive, and we're beginning science to catch up with the Lakotas on that.
Yeah.
I'm beginning to understand that indeed trees do communicate to each other. You might have a line of trees, and if one tree begins to experience an assault by a certain kind of fungus, the tree further down the line gets the information and is able to build up a defense against that fungus. So we know now that trees do communicate. There's been some very interesting work of galvanic skin response kinds of recordings of plants, and how if you go and you rip one plant in a greenhouse, if you rip a plant out of the pot, the other plants will have suddenly start spiking on this galvanic skin response. You know, being very upset about that. And there was even a suggestion that when you even think about ripping a plant from its roots, that there gets to be a reaction by the plant that you're thinking about. So there's getting to be some very interesting experiments about that there's a consciousness to plants and animals. And, of course, you know, we keep discovering, oh, my gosh, elephants grieve. And, you know, apes can put tunes together. And we keep saying that, wow, isn't that, we never thought that, you know. And that animals experience pain. Well, of course they experience pain. So there's it's like sometimes the Native Americans really are ahead of us on that.
Right.
I mean, they understand we're just an animal. We're just a two-legged among four-leggeds. So it's a very different kind of treatment. And so one of the things, if somebody comes to my husband and asks for healing, he will ask the spirits to, he'll do ceremony and he'll ask the spirits to come and help this person. Now, helping this person. I remember there was a physician who had breast cancer, and it spread to her liver, and she was told that she was going to be dead within a couple of months. And so, she came to him, and at first he did some Reiki healing on her, and then he thought, what the heck, I'm going to use my medicine. And she didn't know that he was doing that. And after some treatment with him, her liver count went down. I mean, it was really good. And she was able to live, I think, for 9 or 10 months, much longer than she thought. But when we ask for healing in the Native American tradition, sometimes healing comes in the form of death,
yeah.
Whereas in that would not be considered healing in the Western, in the dominant culture. That
you don't always get the answer you were asking for.
Yeah, that's right.
But you get the answer that's right for you and your place in the universe. And and that's sometimes difficult for us to comprehend or accept.
Yeah. So the three Winona books have been, I realized after I wrote them how healing they were. I mean, and they were very healing books to people on dealing with various aspects. I was just kind of surprised with the Unraveling Thread, because that is a funny book, and it does have about the velocardiofacial syndrome, and it does show about how families struggle. But I didn't write it to be a healing book. I didn't have that in mind. I just wanted to get the information out, and I wanted to write a fun book for people to read, an easy book for people to read. But I think, I can't get away from being a psychologist.
It's a great balance. It was very intriguing, too. I mean, there's so many neat dynamics amongst these people, and they're quite delightful characters. And it is an easy read. I think I read it in one day. And, so it was very pleasant to read in that respect as well. So thank you very much for all your good work with this. And I will have to go read your Winona series now and make sure that I get the privilege of reading those as well. It's interesting to get your perspective also on Lakota medicine, and I hear a lot of themes that are very similar to Chinese medicine.
Uh-huh.
So much is about balance.
Yes.
And trying to make sure that you have the right balance, not only just within the humors of your body, but also in your place in the universe.
Uh-huh.
And as you say, to mix laughter, even in difficult situations, that's when we need laughter the most, in order to regain our balance.
Yeah. But I know we didn't end up talking about depression like I think you originally thought we were going to. I will share with you one thing before we leave, Joyce, because, I was thinking about the depression. And, I think there's a resilience factor that people are born with. And so I've been one of these lucky individuals, even though I've suffered losses and tribulations and stuff. I think I was born with an optimistic personality. But there was one time when I was having some difficulty, and I turned to the spirits. I took my pipe out, my sacred pipe out, and I was praying. And I was told, when you're having a hard time, there are three things you have to do. And so I said, well, what's that? And I was told, one is you have to get up every morning and you have to give a prayer of thanksgiving for your life that day. That you have to, and that's adopt that attitude of gratitude for life. And the second thing was you have to surround yourself with music, which I thought was really interesting. And the third one was you have to dance your body through space. Well, I thought, that's ridiculous. I don't dance. I'm just too klutzy. But then I realized that it was meaning that you have to experience your physical body, and exercise is very helpful. So I thought, I'll share that with Joyce.
Very good. Thank you. Yeah, I understand your husband has some music recording that's available as well?
No, he's a storyteller. And he's got a CD of it's a Grandpa Sings Alone's favorite tales, and that was for children, and those are traditional stories, Native American stories. And then he's got one called Coyote Soup for for the grown-up soul, which is a riot.
Oh, fun.
I mean, it's hysterical. And some of it is about the Native American, but some of it is from the time when he was a minister and how that was the wrong path for him, and the spirits were trying to show him that that was the wrong path. And so he has a book called Sprinting Backwards to God, which was, he says it's for people who, when they are reaching out to God and to the spiritual and finding they can't move forward, sometimes you just have to sprint backwards. So he's a very funny man.
He sounds delightful.
Yeah.
And so are you. And thank you so much.
You're welcome, Joyce.
I hope you've enjoyed our conversation with Priscilla Kogan. I certainly have enjoyed it myself. It's always interesting, too, to examine a different path of spirituality, because we all have our own pathways to God. Even within a particular religion, everybody's experience is a little bit different. And it's always interesting to see how different cultures express their pathway. So this was very interesting to me to hear about the balance with nature, the balance with the animals, and being grateful for the contribution of each of the animals. One of the things that she mentioned about hunting an animal with respect, in American Indian culture, when you kill a deer or something, you kill it for food, not for sport. And you give thanks to the animal for giving his life so that you can survive yourself. And they also are very careful to utilize every portion of the animal. So not just the flesh, but the skin of the animal, different parts like that. And anything that's left over is buried carefully and respectfully. So it's that total respect that the animals were looking for in her story, and that we want to try to achieve in balance with nature. We've talked about that in the nutrition programs that we've done before, that we want to interact with the earth in a way that's sustainable over time. We don't want to just go use up the earth or the resources that have been given to us. We want to make sure that we give back to the earth so that we will have crops the year later and 5 years later and 10 years later and so on. So balance is important. Just to keep the term balance in mind, we need to keep our balance in many ways, spiritually, physically, with some exercise, managing our stress, and taking care of ourselves through whatever life holds for us, the challenges that we encounter as we go forward in life. So I hope that you will have a good week, and we'll see you again next week here on The Powerful Patient. We're going to talk about health care and how we can make sure that we get quality health care. There's really an effort going on now throughout the healthcare system to try to improve quality control and make sure that fewer mistakes occur, that things happen right the first time, even in emergency situations. But in all aspects of hospitals, there's still more mistakes than we would like to know about that do occur in hospitals every day. How can we reduce that number? How can we improve the quality of care that we all get? And how can we as patients help the doctors and the nurses to give us quality care? We all want them to do their best for us. How can we support them in doing that? So this is Joyce Graff. I hope that you will have a great week ahead, and be well and be a powerful patient.